Do many of your students know your personal history?
I've taught for years at the University of Oklahoma, where I taught in their law school. And about 15 years ago, I moved to Massachusetts. Brandeis is right outside of Boston. And here, I teach in a school of social policy. And quite honestly, some of the students know about my background. Some don't. I teach what seems to be an increasingly young group of people, although I do teach graduate students primarily. That's where my appointment is. Of course, we have to realize that in 1991, many of the students who are on campuses today, the undergraduate students in particular, weren't even born yet. And some of our grad students were really children and probably too young to know about the 1991 Clarence Thomas confirmation hearing.
Is that an advantage for you when you're teaching, that they don't know that history?
I think what I teach is so content-oriented, and I don't teach about me, as I say. There are plenty of subjects in law that I cover, so I'm not sure that it matters either way. It can either get people very interested or sort of pique their curiosity about questions that the government and the way the process works. Or it can maybe confuse people or distract people. What I try to do is to teach what I teach and to have content-based teaching in my courses. So I've learned to deal with it either way, whether it could be a positive or a negative.
You're coming to Asheville as the featured speaker at an event that marks the 40th anniversary of Our Voice, the local rape crisis center. What message do you intend to deliver?
What I want to do is really tell the audience how significant the work is that Our Voice is doing. It's important on so many levels. Their mission, of course, is specifically about sexual assault and abuse. And one of the things that I think people will think is, well, what does that have to do with me? If you look at the statistics, what you will learn is that sexual assault and abuse has affected so many people. We think it's just a small segment of the population, but really, if you look at the statistics, 1 out of every 8 women, 30-something percent of the victims in North Carolina are Black, 64-65% are white. People of all ages, whether they're children, young adults, or the elderly, people who have disabilities are affected. But I also want people to know that sexual assault and abuse is part of a spectrum of behavior, so that even if you personally haven't been abused, many of the women have suffered from sexual harassment, and so have some of the men. Many of their children will have suffered from sexualized bullying. And so what I want them to know is that this sexual assault is just a part of a spectrum of behavior, in that if you start thinking about the full spectrum and the way things sort of cross lines when we think of sexual assault and abuse and all the full gamut of the behavior, then you'll realize that every one of us has some experience either with it personally or with friends or family members who have suffered.
You have been quoted as saying the Senate hearings back in 1991 were a disservice to everyone. What do you mean by that, and how would you improve the process?
Well, first of all, I think it was a disservice in a number of ways. There are some specific ways it was a disservice. It seems to me that, but just in general, that all of our public hearings are there to help inform the public. They're there to help us understand how the Senate works when it works at its best and how they make the right decision for the entire country. In 1991, in those hearings, the public was left with a lot of misinformation, and they were left with just really kind of a political take on what is a very real social and cultural problem of sexual harassment. And I think that was really a disservice. That's only one level, if you will. One simple way that they could have better served the public was to be better informed themselves. And that would have been done by having experts on the issue of sexual harassment talk with them, help them shape their questions so that they could have gotten really to the truth in a way that would have helped the public. And then the second way would have been for them to have brought those experts on to testify so that they could, the experts, who I didn't know, could have explained what happens in a situation in the workplace where an individual is sexually harassed. And then finally, having one of the things, very specific things that the Senate did not do was to call witnesses, women who I didn't know, but whose experiences with Clarence Thomas were very similar to mine, and had those individuals testify publicly and be subject to the same informed set of questions. I think all of those would have helped improve the process and given people a better sense of what the problem actually is, how it presents itself, and what the impact was, and then finally, why it was significant to a hearing involving the fitness of an individual who was going to be given a lifetime appointment deciding cases on sexual harassment and other very important issues of equality.
Are elected officials, and for that matter, the general public, better informed today, and therefore a similar hearing today would be quite different?
I do believe a hearing today could be quite different, but I'm not sure that I would give all of the credit to it being different today to our elected officials. I think sometimes they get these issues right and sometimes they don't get it so right. But I do give a lot of credit to the general public and to organizations like Our Voice, where we have for the last 23 years, and in terms of Our Voice, that's celebrating their 40th anniversary, we've informed people. We've let people know about these issues. We've kept the conversation going so that now as we address sexual assault and harassment in our colleges and universities, we have a better chance at having a more truthful and honest and informed conversation.
You testified for a committee that was all men. Today there are 20 women in the Senate. Does that make a significant difference?
I think it makes a significant difference in terms of the way the conversations take shape. In 1991, the Senate, you're right, there were two women in the Senate itself, so that if a colleague wants to talk with other colleagues in the Senate about what do you think of this, then you really don't necessarily have anyone who's experienced sexual harassment. You don't have people that the colleagues can have conversation with about what does it mean, how does it work, what should we be thinking about, might we be missing something. I think now with 20 women, we're reaching a sort of critical mass, if you will. Not there yet, but at least we're coming closer to a critical mass where the conversations can be more informed by the experiences of women. One of the things, though, that we don't necessarily talk about, but I think that the film, Anita, which is just sort of revisits the hearing, one of the things it points out is that, in fact, there was also a gap, if you will, in their understanding of race as they talked about the hearings, and as Judge Thomas, suggested that the hearings were a high-tech lynching. The numbers in the Senate of racial inclusion and diversity have not improved significantly. But I do think that racial diversity, there may have been a better conversation about that claim of a high-tech lynching. So we have a way to go. And I do think that having greater diversity in the Senate, gender diversity and racial diversity, will help the Senate do its job better and help represent more of us fully.
The documentary film Anita Speaking Truth to Power was released in March. Back in 1991, you described yourself at the time as a conservative. How have your politics evolved since 1991?
I don't think I ever described myself as a conservative. I tend not to use labels to describe myself. I think some people have described me as a conservative, but I don't think I describe my politics at all. And I say that because I've always felt that I'm quite progressive on issues of race and gender and sexual identity equality. Although I will say that I have worked in some very conservative political environments, including working with the Reagan administration. And I began my teaching career working at Oral Roberts University, an evangelical college, if you will, in their law school. So I think that's how the idea that I was a conservative came about. But in terms of my views about the progress that needs to be made, the importance of robust enforcement of rights, the importance of our understanding of the significance of race and gender and on our culture and structures in this country, those haven't changed.
You seem as though you are a very private person. Why did, after many years, you agree to do the documentary film?
Well, now, that's where I would describe myself. As, I would use that term. I am a private person, and I didn't come to doing the film lightly. But it is because of what I have been able to see as a private person in the last 22 years, that includes hearing from a lot of people who believe and understand that the world has changed since we started in 1991 to address the issue of sexual harassment and other kinds of abuses publicly. So that's part of what I have received over the past 22 years, but also as a individual who has spent her life her professional life in universities, that's part of my private life. It's part of what I do. And I see a generation of women who are still confronting many of the issues that we tried to address and respond to in 1991 and have since been trying to respond to. Nevertheless, they keep recurring. And I think it's time for us, as we look at this film, to ask ourselves some hard questions. How far along have we come, and what do we need to do to push the issues further?
Is the most difficult question you faced, why say nothing for a decade and why stay associated with Clarence Thomas?
Well, my association with Clarence Thomas was, after I left Washington, D.C., was very limited. I didn't really have maybe one or two contacts with him, and one happened at the death of a very close mutual friend. Why stay silent? You have to understand that in 1991, when I testified, I was not making a personal claim against Clarence Thomas. In 1991, when the Senate approached me about my experience, they were considering, once again, they were considering an individual who was going to be appointed to the highest court in this country. And it was going to be a lifetime appointment. And they were considering all aspects of his character and fitness for that position. And I had direct information from direct experience that went to the character and fitness for this position on the Supreme Court. And as a lawyer and as a citizen, I had to come forward and tell them what I knew. And that's why I spoke out as I did. and tried to do it in a way that was very specific about what happened to me.
What's your life like today at now approaching 60 years of age?
My life is it's what you imagine, a woman who has gone through some difficulties, but and many of us have. I'm not the only one, and I know that I'm not in that position alone. I've heard from many others who are like me. We're at a point in our lives and in our careers where we know that what we do can not only be important to us, but to other people as well. And I think I, at least, I want to figure out what it is that I can do to not only make my life fulfilling, but make it meaningful as it relates to other people. So that's where I am in my life. That's where I am in my career. And I'd like to say that it's a good place to be.
I know you don't like labels or political labels especially, but do you consider yourself a feminist?
Yes. And I think that this idea of labeling somebody a feminist, it means probably different things to people, and I know for a lot of people it's a pejorative. If I get to define what feminism is to me, it is really a true belief in gender equality and also a recognition that our systems and structures and even the way we talk about women puts many of us at a disadvantage. Some of it is conscious, some of it is unconscious, but it really is a disservice to all of us in humanity, whether or not we're women or men. So that the disadvantage that women suffer is not just something that happens to women. It happens to their families, and it happens to impact the men and boys in their lives. And it's something that it was just going to take a lot of work for us to overcome.
How closely do you watch the court, the Supreme Court?
I watch the court. You know, there are some major decisions in particular that came out in the 2013 term that were decisions about equality decisions that were important. There was an important case on sexual harassment and employer responsibility and accountability. The same-sex marriage case, the Windsor case came out. There was a really important voting rights case that came out. Those are the cases that I watch closely. But I also have come from a background of commercial law and contracts. I'm also interested in some of the decisions that have to do with economics that come out.
Does Clarence Thomas's silence on the bench surprise you?
You know, I don't really think that much about it. I tell people that I don't really try to evaluate Clarence Thomas and his position as a justice or as a jurist, because I know that I cannot be objective. And so there are many people who will talk about Clarence Thomas and what he does and his jurisprudence, his opinions. I will not.
Going back to the issue of feminism, you work with students, and I wonder if the women in your classes, do they have a different view of what it means to be a feminist?
They not only have a different view of what it means to be a feminist than I do at times, they also have their own views that are varied among women their age. So I think one of the things that we can be proud of among young people is that they are actually exploring these issues on their own, and they're making up their own minds. And they're coming to an understanding given what their life experience is about. They've contextualized it in a 21st century way. And that's really what's going to move us forward. So it's not too important to me necessarily that their view is like mine, but it is important to me that they understand all of the dynamics and then come to it in ways that will move us forward into this century and beyond.
Anita Hill is a professor at Brandeis University. The documentary film Anita, Speaking Truth to Power, was released in March. She will be in Asheville to speak at the 40th year celebration of Our Voice. Anita Hill, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, and I'm looking forward to spending some time in Asheville.
So when are you actually going to be in Asheville?
I'm coming around the 3rd. I should look at the calendar.
So you're going to have some time.
The 3rd.
Yes, I'll have some time.
And I'll have a little time, and I'll make the most of the time that I have.
Okay. Again, I very much appreciate the amount of time you've given me here today. And let me just clarify. I will do slight edit on this, and almost the entire interview will be posted on our website, and then a much shorter version will be on the air.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your effort and your thoughtful questions, and I look forward to listening probably on the website. I may not to hear it on air, but I'm looking forward to taking a look on the website when it's up.
Thank you very much again for your time. I appreciate it. You know, it's interesting.
It can really help society. It can help our clients. And it can help the people who are impacted by it.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I am proud of that, very proud of that. And I think that there is a generation of lawyers. Every class graduates lawyers who have that in mind when they think about what the profession is and what it should be.
You know, my dad went to law school at Wayne State in Michigan, and was a member of the bar his entire life. He died a few years ago at 95, but he never practiced law. And he once, you know, in his 90s, even though he was a member of the bar, he said to me once, you know, sometimes I think I wish I had practiced law, which was contrary to what he told me many times leading up to his 90s. I just thought it was interesting that he maintained his membership in the bar but never practiced law.
Yeah, well, I had when I left Washington, you know, I was not in a practice per se, and then I went into teaching. And then I was in teaching for 30 years, and it took me for a while to come back as of counsel. And I still don't consider what I do as a practice. I consider myself an advisory position. But it took some thought for me to even want to go back into it at all, to have this affiliation with a firm.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's always an ambivalence.
Yeah.
That we feel like, oh, really? Do I want to get into that or don't I? And I'm sure at some point in my life I will be reading a case or talking to an attorney about their work and say, you know, maybe I should have practiced. So right now I like what I'm doing. I think I'm right at this point where I need to be in terms of how I view my participation in the profession. But I can kind of feel where your father may have been at the end of his life.
Yeah, because, you know, as I said, my brother's an attorney. One of my sons is an attorney. And it is interesting to hear their observations on the practice. You know, one's a young lawyer, and my brother's recently retired. So, and they have different views of the practice. It's interesting. Anyway, thanks again very much for your time.
And I'm sure if you talk to journalists, you'd have the same.
Oh, yeah. Don't ask me about journalism right now. I'm not real happy with that practice right now.
Well, yeah, I think we all go through these trends and. But just as I say, just remember why you started.
Yeah.
Again, and you'll find some people who are in the same place that you are.
Yeah. Well, so, enjoy your visit to Asheville. It's a beautiful area and beautiful town.
Well, thank you, and I'm looking forward to it, and keep doing your journalism.
All right. Thanks again, and hopefully bye-bye. We'll meet here in Asheville. Bye-bye.